5, Education Subcommittee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, and open a public hearing on SB 5509. Before we start testimony, I'd like to indicate that Senator Walker is excused today. Representative Wisnett is actually testifying on a bill. I'm leaving in about 30 seconds to testify on another bill. When I return, I believe Senator Gordley will be leaving shortly thereafter to testify on another bill. But I will be there.
Actually, I won't have to do that.
Oh, you won't have to do that.
My staff is going to take
okay.
care of it.
Okay. So it might be a case of a few people moving up here, and I haven't heard from any of the other committee members. This seems to be the time already when people are being called out to testify on bills. So, with that, why don't you go ahead and start, and I will turn the gavel over to Senator Gordley.
Good morning.
Good morning. For the record, Deputy Superintendent Vicki Fleming, Oregon Department of Education. We're going to try to stay on task and on schedule and ask your indulgence this morning. Yesterday, we had quite a bit of opportunity to talk about grounding you in the context of the work from a school district superintendent and from a corporate CEO. And we want to go from that broad view of the educational enterprise today to a more specific discussion office by office. We'd like to keep to the schedule today to talk about the Office of Educational Improvement and Innovation and the Office of Assessment and Information Services. And we'll hold our conversation about the superintendent's office and until later in our three-day period. If we have time today, we'd like to talk about the Office of Finance and Administration as well. So with that, I know there's been quite a bit of conversations in the building about a variety of things yesterday. It caused quite a bit of excitement, and Brian Reeder is here. We'd really like to be able to get through the presentation about our offices, but if you have questions about that, he is here and ready to answer what those numbers might mean. So I think yesterday you got a sense of this being a very large corporate enterprise and a very decentralized management structure, and we're going to continue to talk to you about what we do office by office and how it relates to a local school district. So I would now like to turn over the conversation to Dr. Salam Noor, who's the Assistant Superintendent in the Office of Educational Improvement and Innovation.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Senator Gordley, members of the committee. For the record, Salam Noor, Oregon Department of Education. Appreciate the opportunity to share some information with you today. My presentation will build on the remarks and comments you heard yesterday relative to the agency core functions and how those functions affect districts and contribute to student achievement. In this handout that you have the offices listed and you have the core functions that each office performs. My office, the Office of Educational Improvement and Innovation, covers six major areas. Those are federal programs, primarily No Child Left Behind, curriculum and instruction, professional technical education, private career schools, alternative education, and school and district improvement. So those are the areas that I will focus on today in my presentation. And to illustrate specifically the work that the department does in relationship to Oregon districts and schools, I will provide an example using that as a context in terms of how a district actually engages the department and how, relative to these specific six functions, and how the district actually benefits from the services it receives from the department. In order to assist with that, we developed a profile. You will find it in your packet in the blue folder on the right hand side. This is actually a profile of an actual district, but we decided to not disclose its name, and we refer to it here as Pioneer School District. I will tell you, however, that this district belongs to one of you. So,
okay. So you. Madam Chair,
Representative Arch.
Just to make sure that we're all on the same page, you held up this, and then now we're into your blue document.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
This is the profile, and I will be referring to the profile and the information in the profile as I go through these six areas that we have direct responsibility for. The first item that I would like to discuss is standards. There are different types of standards the department is responsible for developing and maintaining. From a systems level, you heard from Superintendent J.R. Wilson yesterday, you heard him talk about Division 22 standards. Those are really the system standards that the department implements based on Oregon statutes, and these standards actually define what constitutes a standard school in our state. These are primarily operational standards that promote uniformity and consistency across the state and include areas such as curriculum and instruction requirements, safety, instructional days and hours, graduation requirements, career education requirements, and district improvement plan requirements. In your blue folder, the second item on the right-hand side, the third item, you have also a list of the Division 22 standards for you to reference. And this is the abbreviated version, and each one of those standards has a list of indicators associated with it that helps districts determine whether they are meeting that standard or not. The districts submit an assurance form that Jerry Wilson talked about yesterday to the department to ensure that they are complying with all these requirements and that they are a standard district. I also will share with you that we're revising and updating these rules to make sure that they are current and applicable to today's educational system. Also, Superintendent Wilson yesterday shared with you that districts have planning requirements that they must submit to the Department of Education based on both state guidelines and federal guidelines. I would like to share with you that as a result of the reorganization that the department had gone through over the last couple of years, the last 18 months specifically, we were able to achieve some efficiency by combining and consolidating those planning requirements. Currently, districts are required to submit a consolidated district improvement plan that's required by the state. They're required to submit a consolidated federal programs application to the department. They also submit sub-program applications based on Title I, Title III, Title IV, etc. They submit a Perkins application for vocational and technical education programs, and they also submit an IDEA application and assurances. What we have done as a result of our reorganization that allowed us to combine three offices and another unit together into a single office is develop one single planning process and one single application that the department submits to us and satisfy the federal, state, and other requirements. That is the continuous improvement plan, and it's also included in your packet. This is the abbreviated version, but it also includes the standards that a district has to meet, the common goals and performance measures, and additional requirements. But what we've done is we really have streamlined that process immensely and eased the life of districts, and I think it makes it much more efficient for us to look at it holistically rather than in component parts. This planning process results in a comprehensive plan that reflects the district's overall goals and strategies to accomplish those goals, again, irrespective of the funding stream. The main benefits to having a set of standards, like Division 22 standards and rules, is that we end up as a state with a uniform and quality educational system with common elements throughout the state. We end up with a comprehensive district-wide planning effort and a single plan that allows for leveraging of all funds, so we're not developing a plan for state funds and a plan for federal funds. We actually have a single plan that combines all of those resources, targeting a common set of goals and priorities. We also compel the districts then, as a result, to focus on those goals and priorities and connect them in an integrated fashion. We provide professional development, we provide support, we provide resources and technical assistance to districts in the implementation of Division 22 standards. We're constantly fielding questions.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you. Could you talk to me just a little bit about professional development?
Sure. Senator Gordley, Representative Jensen, we provide professional development in the form of workshops to help districts understand Division 22 requirements, to help them implement those requirements in their district. We provide technical assistance relative to the planning. A good example of that is what we're currently doing in collaboration with ESDs. We're actually co-sponsoring about a dozen workshops throughout the state relative to the continuous improvement planning framework. And I neglected to mention that we took Division 22 standards and folded them into the continuous improvement planning framework. So the department, in collaboration with ESDs, will invite districts and educators from the region to come to the ESDs to receive training on the rules, on the requirements as stipulated in state and federal law, and how to fill out the application forms and complete the process.
May I follow?
Certainly.
from my experience over the years in talking with and participating in, most teachers, if professional development is what you're talking about, most teachers will tell you that these things are the biggest waste of time they have in the year. Excuse me for being putting it that way, but do you have any anything that can relieve my anxieties in relationship to that particular observation?
Senator Gorley, Representative Jensen, I sure hope so. We have different types of professional development that we offer throughout the state, and as I get into the standards, the content standards, I will share with you the types of professional development that we provide specifically to teachers. We do evaluations on every workshop that we offer, and I'm glad to tell you that most of the feedback that we receive is very positive, is very constructive, and we take that feedback seriously to continue to improve those workshops and enhance them so they meet the needs of those teachers. Quite often, we use teachers to offer professional development to other teachers, so it's not the department standing there in front of them. We provide them some general guidelines, but we typically recruit teachers, very capable, very qualified teachers, to train their colleagues. Most of the professional development that we offer, whether it's in a state in the form of a statewide institute or a targeted institute like the Arts Institute or the Science Institute or the Math Institute for a specific group of teachers, most often they're full and we actually have to turn people away. We offered a professional development opportunity last summer as a school improvement and literacy institute. We had over 400 teachers participating in that institute. We had 75 members from community colleges also participating in that institute. That leads me to believe that there is value in what we do and how we do it. And I would certainly welcome hearing from those teachers that you've interacted with and would like to know how we can improve those workshops and make them effective and make them suitable for their needs.
Thank you.
Senator Nelson.
I go back to the start with this thing. Division 22 rules, these are the rules that the department has made up. Are these based upon federal requirements, state requirements, or how does this all come about?
Senator Gordley, Senator Nelson, those rules are based on state statutes, Oregon state statutes. Oregon statutes define what constitutes a quality district and a standard school. The department has the responsibility for interpreting those statutes and developing rules to ensure their implementation at the local level.
Do you have any internal audits of your own that look at these things and say you're doing a good job or a bad job or you need to improve or what?
Senator Gorley, Senator Nelson, we rely on the feedback that we receive from districts, and some of the feedback that we received just recently over the last couple of years in particular suggested to us that we needed to revise the rules. Some of these rules are dated, some of them don't really apply to today's educational environment. And I'm happy to share with you that we just went through a revision process over the last month in particular where we consulted a number of superintendents and principals in the field. We brought them together, had them work with them to walk through the rules one by one, and they provided us some very valuable feedback that we're incorporating into those revisions. Once we revise the rules based on external feedback from districts and our own work, we will go out to the field for additional input and feedback, and then we'll go through the rulemaking process to revise the rules.
One quick question. And I'm still getting reports from particularly my smaller schools in my district, and I have 23 school districts in my center district. They just feel like they're inundated with these reports, and they don't ever get any. I mean, at least they're telling me, anecdotally, that they don't really get any value out of it. I mean, they send in the reports, so what? I mean, they never get any feedback from them.
Senator Gorley, Senator Nelson, under the category of district and school improvement, that's an area that we're trying to address to make those reports real for the districts and for us as well. The continuous improvement planning framework that I shared with you briefly becomes the basis for interacting with districts. In the past, I will admit, the department collected these plans, and those plans were not really monitored very closely. It was basically designed to satisfy a state and a federal requirement. We have the level of data today that allows us to look at individual student performance in every district. This is wonderful data that we can provide to districts and help them use it in a meaningful way. I think when we start to use the plans and the districts use the plans in a meaningful meaningful way, they will see the value in them. And we've made it very clear to districts that this will become the mechanism for interacting with them. If the district needs to make some improvements, we're going to go back to their plan and make sure we review the plan with them, identify the areas that need to be improved, and incorporate that into the plan. So we're trying to make these much more applicable. We're trying to make them real for us and for the districts, and we're trying to build capacity internally and in the field in terms of tools for data analysis, data interpretation, and transforming those into action plans at the local level.
What you're describing is a process that has been underway for a short period of time. You're transforming the way in which the department does its business in relationship to providing a service and expecting feedback from your district constituency, if you will. But you're on the front end of beginning to do business differently.
Senator Gortley, I fully agree with you. That's essentially what we're trying to do. We're trying to transform the culture internally and externally. We're trying to provide a mechanism for sound and effective planning at the local level, and that, and to make sure that the tools that we provide are useful and are meaningful to districts specifically. Do you want to say something, Vicki?
Representative March.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I said this in the Education Committee on which I serve, but I want to, from my constituents in Multnomah County, I want to thank the department for working with us on looking at things like cohort growth and individual growth and your new ability to track individual students and showing where the additional money that my constituents put into the schools actually got to the students and made improvements. And I think that's valuable information, and it's really helped our folks to understand that, yes, you can make a difference.
Let's go back to Senator Nelson for a moment.
Just another thing, since we're talking about this, and I hope you take this in a constructive nature, but I'm just giving you feedback from what I'm hearing out there. The other thing I'm hearing a lot from my folks is just saying, well, that the department basically is now being made up of people that are really not familiar with how public education K-12 really runs. You've got people that have maybe never even been involved in it, making rules and regulations. I mean, and so I hope you take that in a constructive manner. I don't know if it's true or not. I'm just saying, is there some way you can give some information? I mean, you might be saying, well, this is how a public school should be run, but in reality, that's maybe somebody in your department doesn't really know. And they're saying, but this is how you got to do it. And they're saying, well, this is going to be difficult.
Senator Gordley, Senator Nelson, I don't know to which specific people you are talking about, but we are constantly seeking that balance between how to run and manage a business well and how to manage a set of processes that improve public education. And I think you heard Ken Thrasher yesterday speak to the complicated balance that we have to strike. There isn't anybody who works at the department who is not familiar with public education, so I think that's probably a miscue or an inaccurate perception. I think that the dialogue that you're talking about, particularly with the small rural districts, that combining processes and trying to ease the burden and create processes that are relevant and have some meaning to districts is really what we're after, not creating processes that are all about checking off a compliance or a procedural requirement, but rather having some relevance to getting better at what we do.
Just following, I recall what Representative Jensen brought up yesterday as well, you know, that it's pretty hard to compare a corporation with a public school district. There are some significant differences. Mm-hmm. That's all I
have. Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Knorr, I was looking over your educational improvement innovation, your semi-hypothetical Pioneer District, okay? And you do have the number of students there, but how many employees are there in the Pioneer District? How many actual classroom teachers, exclusive of counselors, librarians, and special education specialists? What is the diversity of those teachers? And also, what percent of the total Pioneer District budget is dedicated to employee compensation, both salary and benefits?
Senator Gordley, Senator Witsa, I don't have that information specifically on the profile. I geared the profile towards the items that I was going to present on. But I think we can get you some of that information if you would like, if you would like to have that displayed as part of the profile. I believe some of that information is available at the district, and I will be more than happy to provide you that. We have some information on the classes, staffing, and teachers, where we just show the percentages of licensed staff, instructional assistants, school administrators, and perhaps the expenditures associated with that. But the actual number I really don't have with me, but I believe I can get that for you if you would like.
I think those are critical to the how a school district is run and how effective it can be.
Yes, we will be more than happy to get those numbers for you. The other area of standards that you heard about briefly yesterday is the content standard, and the department is responsible for the development and ongoing revisions and updating of the academic content standards in eight content areas, and those include math, science, English language arts, social sciences, second world languages, the arts, health, and physical education. We also ensure that districts provide a comprehensive educational program that includes all content areas, and our mechanism for doing that is the Division 22 standards and currently the SIP. The content standards can be found in the Oregon Standards newspaper in your packet on the left-hand side, and this is one of the products that the department publishes annually, and it has a list of all the content standards at every benchmark level. And this is distributed widely. We distribute about anywhere from $60,000 to $80,000 newspapers every biennium. It's in high demand by teachers. They use it in their classroom. Districts use it for professional development activities. And we also know that our Oregon University partners use it for in-service and pre-service teacher development as well. Developing and revising the content standards involves Oregon teachers and post-secondary partners, and we work hard to align those content standards with higher education entrance requirements. You will see that these content standards are aligned with the past proficiencies for the Oregon University system. And the department also provides professional development tools and resources that districts can use, such as the Online Teaching and Learning Resource Center, the Searchable Standards webpage, the Strategies for Student Success webpage, which focuses on research-based strategies and best practices. We also offer professional development institutes to your question, Senator, Representative Jensen. We offer an arts institute annually, a science institute, a math institute. We offer curriculum mapping and alignment activities, so teachers have the tools to align the content and the curriculum that they use in their classroom to the state standards to make sure that students have the opportunity to meet those standards and be successful. The way the standards are developed is through content and assessment panels. We have teachers from every level that participate in the content and assessment panels. They represent statewide geography, if you will, and the teachers make a recommendation as to what the standards should be. Some of the key outcomes for having content standards is that we end up with common content standards taught in all Oregon schools. We have rigorous and challenging standards developed through research and by Oregon teachers and university faculty. We have clear expectations of what students should know and be able to do at every level of the educational continuum, K-12 specifically to us. We also have regularly updated standards and aligned with national standards. And through the professional development, we end up with a well-trained and highly qualified teacher corps. The second area that I would like to share with you is federal programs, and specifically the No Child Left Behind programs that my office is responsible for. The department is responsible for statewide coordination, implementation, and oversight of No Child Left Behind programs and requirements. We manage 14 No Child Left Behind programs, totaling approximately $350 million. By looking at the district profile in particular, if I may direct your attention to page 5 of the profile, you will see that this district has 9 federal programs.
Where are we at with this thing?
First page.
This is the profile, page 5. The Pioneer School District. Yes, sir. So on, if I may direct your attention to page 5, you will see that the district receives 9 federal grants under No Child Left Behind. I would suggest that you multiply that by 192 districts that receive similar grants from us, and some districts receive 9, some receive all 14. The department works with this district, for example, to administer and manage those grants, including determination of eligibility to receive those funds, funding and distribution formulas relative to those funds, allocation for each program, and the disbursement of funds. The department is also responsible for developing application process for formula and competitive grants. Some of these grants are rolled out on a formula basis. Some of them are competitive and involve us issuing an RFP, reviewing competitive applications, and issuing a grant award as a result. The department also provides, develops and provides regulatory guidance and requirements for each program based on the federal legislation. If I may also direct your attention to a specific element relative to those grants, you will see that this district receives approximately $2.4 million of Title I funds. The district will rely heavily on the Title I handbook that the department publishes and in which we describe requirements and expectations under the law, allowable expenditures, roles and responsibilities of the state education agency and the local education agency and staff, accountability measures relative to making progress, and we also use that as a tool to provide technical assistance and resources. In addition, the department conducts on-site program review and evaluation. The title requires visits to Title III ELL programs, for example, and this district receives Title III grant, so most likely it will receive a visit by a team from the Department of Education. And the law also requires us to monitor and review districts with a large Title I student population. In addition, we collect, review, and analyze district, school, and student performance data. We provide statewide professional development and training in coordination with partners such as the Northwest Regional Educational Lab, the ESDs, the Oregon University System. We also collaborate with professional organizations or professional teacher associations like the Oregon Association of Comprehensive Education to offer two annual conferences. We provide training to administrators at the COSA institutes. We offer a Closing the Achievement Gap conference to focus attention students that are struggling in our system and need some additional assistance. And we also have more specific targeted training such as the English Language Proficiency Standards, 21st Century Community Learning Centers, Migrant Education, etc. We also identify and disseminate best practices and effective strategies relative to NCLB in general, but specifically to each one of these program areas based on research and effective strategies that teachers can use in the classroom. The result of this relationship between the department and districts, and this district specifically, is that we are able to provide clarity to the district with regard to the implementation and accountability requirements as prescribed in federal law. We provide clear guidance relative to fiscal accountability and the appropriate use of the funds. The focus is on student achievement. We're always tying district plans and district activities to student achievement to make sure that those activities actually positively impact student achievement. And we're always focused on increasing the student achievement of the student populations that those funds are intended for in order to close the achievement gap.
Mr. Knorr, could you comment, looking at page 5 and looking at the Pioneer District profile, what would be the factors that would result in the Pioneer District receiving less than the state average in general funds per student, and also less than the state average for operating funds spent per student?
Senator Gordley, I would prefer to defer that question to Brian Reeder. He's much more knowledgeable of the finances of district than I am. We pull the data out of our database that provides you all this information on every district in this state. But in an attempt to answer that question is that the weighted formula allows for some discrepancies, perhaps. But Brian is much more qualified. He's nodding his head, so he's agreeing with what I'm saying. So.
Senator
Whitsitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Knorr, on the, when you talk about all operating funds spent per student, I'm assuming that means your distribution funds and your federal funds, and it would be exclusive of local taxes, fees generated from parents and students, franchises, and capital expenditures, and that sort of thing.
Senator Gordley, Senator Whitsitt, I believe those refer specifically to the general fund. And the federal funds allow for some of those expenditures, but we don't have them broken down here. I believe the top portion of the page refers specifically to the general funds that the district receives. And in our reference to all operating funds spent per student, I believe we are talking specifically about the general funds.
That would also be exclusive of federal funds, then, too. It would also be exclusive of federal funding, also.
Senator Gordley, Senator Whitsitt, correct.
Did you wish to...
For the record, Brian Reeder, Department of Education, Senator Gordley, Senator Whitsitt. The department uses a definition of operating expenditures that is virtually identical to what the federal Department of Education calls current expenditures, and that would include expenditures out of three different funds. General funds, what we call special funds, which is comprised largely of federal revenue, and then enterprise funds, which is where much of the fee revenue would be deposited. So the answer to your question is this operating expenditure, when it says all operating funds, that would be more comprehensive than just general fund. It would include the bulk of federal revenue, spending from federal revenue as well as fee revenue. That's why you see a difference here. General funds spent per student of 6103 and all operating funds per student of 7226. That difference there would be largely federal money and fees.
Okay.
It does exclude capital, both capital, direct capital expenditures, and the debt service to pay for those capital expenditures.
A follow-up, please.
Certainly.
Then your department does track the fees charged by the individual districts for whether it be for athletics or journalism or textbooks or whatever, and also the franchise income from machines and lunches and that sort of thing. You do track that.
Senator Gordley, Senator Whitsitt, yes, we do. Any revenue and expenditure that shows up on the books of the district, we do track. This is all audited data, so it's all there. Yes.
So regardless of whether it goes to buying a scoreboard or whatever, you have figures on all that. That's wonderful.
That's correct.
Madam Chair.
Representative Whitsitt.
Thank you. Good morning.
Wisnett, I'm very sorry.
That's okay. I remember now, we've been spending so much time together. thank you, Madam Chair. I think it's important for the committee to know, and Mr. Reeder can confirm, but I think you left out property tax. You said general funds, special funds. So when we're spending money, we're including all that money from the state fund, which is including property tax. Is that not correct?
Senator Gordley, Representative Whitten, that is correct. Those property taxes come to districts. Physically, they come from property taxes. Financially, they come to districts through the formula, and they're all in the general fund.
Yeah. And follow up, Madam Chair.
Certainly.
So I think it's important, because as we ask you, and you were very helpful in giving us the beginning of our testimony, your figure that the actual K-12 budget or amounts of funds available for K-12 is $8.9 billion. Thank you.
Did you have another comment? We often hear a generalization that says No Child Left Behind is a policy directive without enough funding behind it. But we are receiving, if I understand the numbers correctly, we are receiving $350 million in federal funds for No Child Left Behind efforts in Oregon. Is that accurate?
Senator Gordley, that is correct. We received, my office specifically administers $350 million in the form of grants in these 14 program areas.
What would actually be required to meet the standards set by No Child Left Behind if, in fact, the $350 million isn't enough? Have we done that calculation?
Senator Gordley, that is the $64 million question, if you will. I think for us to be able to calculate and do the analysis of what it would cost to support the interventions that would get all populations of students up to 100% of meeting standard is not a calculation that we have done, but it would be a very interesting number for us to calculate. Our deliberations with the congressional delegation have been about continuing to increase, and what we know to be true is that the federal funds are projected to decrease over the next several congressional allocations, and which is really problematic because we have tried to have this precarious balance between our general fund and federal fund investments from the state agency.
Is the calculation a work in progress as well?
Senator Gordley, the Quality Ed Commission calculation would, I think, get us up to the 95% figure, and then beyond that, we have not done that extra 5% in terms of a real number. We could work on that if you would like to have some kind of rough idea of what would get us there. I think maybe Brian could speak to that as well.
Senator Gordley, as you know, the Quality Education Commission makes estimates of the resources required to get 90% of students to meet Oregon standards, and that number translated into a state school fund basis for 05-07 is on the order of $7 billion, which compares to the roughly 5.1 or 5.3 that we're talking about actually having for the state school fund in 05-07. The commission consciously chose not to make an estimate of what it would cost to get 99 or 100% of students to standard based on the notion that we simply don't have enough understanding to make a credible estimate. And the reason we don't is that no state has ever been even close to that level of performance in their school system. So we simply don't have any experience or evidence on which to base such an estimate. What we do know is that as more and more students meet standards, the ones remaining who have not yet met standards are the ones facing the greatest challenges. Students with special needs, various students in poverty and other categories of students who, for a variety of reasons, aren't doing well in school. And we simply don't have any basis to know how much it will cost to get that last 10% to meet Oregon standards. I would say, though, that Oregon has some of the highest standards in the country, and so that marginal cost of getting those last students to meet the standards, I suspect, is quite high, if it's possible at all.
Just a brief comment in response, and thank you. It is interesting that under No Child Left Behind, the standard is 100%, and so we are struggling with this other piece. I think that's work for us to look at during the interim. That's my view. I'll talk about my view with the chair as well. It's work that we need to focus on with the Quality Education Commission. Thank you, Mr. Reeder. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know you've probably covered and gone over this with some of the other questions that have been asked, but I'm looking at the model school you have here versus the state average. And, I do know that significantly less dollars in this school per student. And I thought I was hearing as you went through that part of this was because of the grants or something that, but it's something like 10%, plus or minus a little change, different from the state average. This kind of concerns me in the light of what we try to do as far as equalization. 6,400 versus 7,226, just a little less than $750 per student. And that does strike me as quite a bit of money per student, different. So one of the things that I would be interested in here in relationship to a chart like this is the variance that you have, you know, across the thing as far as students are concerned. I'd be interested in why this model school, I assume this is a real school. If it's not, I apologize. You know, and I'd be interested in why this model school is $750 or 10% behind the funding flow for the average state schools. And I'd also be interested in, you know, how many of the schools are 10% above. I mean, this kind of, because I'm having difficulty looking at equalization within the system, as we will deal with it somewhere, I assume somewhere else when we get to the formula. I'm having difficulty coming to grips with what I'm seeing here.
Senator Gordley, Representative Jensen, first I'll start by saying that the legislature has not attempted to equalize funding per student. It has attempted to equalize funding per weighted student.
I understand that.
Now, these numbers here are dollars per actual student, not dollars per weighted student. And the explanation for why this district has less money than the state average is because through the formula it gets less money, and it gets less money because it has fewer special ed students than average. It has fewer ESL students than average. It has fewer poor students than average. It has fewer pregnant students than average. So it gets less money through the formula per actual student than the average district. This is exactly how the formula is intended to work.
I understand that. That's why I'm looking at the variance that we have, you know, within these categories, sort of thing. So, if that information is available, it would be of at least some benefit to me, if not others, as I try to understand what's going on.
Yeah, Senator Gordley, Representative Jensen, that information is readily available. It is on our website, but I'm happy to provide it to you in one concise table.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you, Madam Chair. I didn't mean to follow up without asking. I'm sorry.
Not a problem. And Mr. Neuer, again, just to clarify, this district profile is based on a real district and one of our districts. Did I hear you say that at the beginning of the presentation?
Senator Gordley, that is correct.
Okay. Would you like to identify the district?
Senator Gordley, I think I don't know if we informed the district that we're going to be using their numbers or not, but it is, in fact, Ben Lapine School District.
All right. Thank you.
I know you figured that out.
Yeah. Yeah, that's seventh largest enrollment number down.
Yeah, it really is helpful in our unpacking this to understand who we're talking about is. As well. Please continue.
Senator Gordley, I just think that great questions, and in fact, by putting this presentation in the context of a real school district,
yes,
it raises additional questions that are helpful to us as well. So.
Wonderful.
We certainly appreciate all the feedback. I think it's going to improve the profile.
Senator Nelson.
I see there's a combination of Oregon Report Card and No Child Left Behind. It did not meet the federal No Child Left Behind. And it has, I guess, above average satisfactory schools, and according to the state average. The question I'm always going to come back to is this: how do you balance the state report card, No Child Left Behind? How do you combine those two things together so that the public is not confused, where you have a school under this say that's okay, and under this one it's not achieving?
Senator Gordley, Senator Nelson, we talked a little bit about that yesterday, and you know that that's on our plan. I want to refer back to the reference that Representative March made to the numbers that we ran for on behalf of Multnomah County. And in fact, what we're headed to is the ability to take student-level data and to compare one student's growth over time as opposed to a cohort of students' growth in third grade and another cohort in fifth grade. And so when we get to a combination of the federal and state requirements, we will have the ability to have real information about how what kind of progress individual students are making over time. And I think rather than get into the technical complexities right now, Doug Costi is going to talk a little bit about what that means in terms of the integrated data system development, what the database looks like that we have to be able to make good, accurate projections of growth and progress over time, and we can have that presentation in the next hour.
I just, I guess, a follow-up, if I could. So, I mean, what part does the TESA program play in all this? Does it do anything for the No Child Left Behind, or is it only Oregon State? Or does it even have a part in it?
Senator Gordley, Senator Nelson, Doug Costi is going to talk about how we deploy our assessment system in a technological context, and he'll be able to give you lots of information about that in the next part of the presentation.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
In the interest of time, I have three areas that I have to cover. So in order to allow for enough time for Doug Costi to share his information with you, I'm going to try and go through these fairly quickly. The third area is professional technical education. The department is responsible for the statewide coordination, implementation, and oversight of the Carl Perkins Vocational and Technical Education Act, referred to in Oregon as professional technical education. On page 6 of the profile, if I may direct your attention to page 6, you will see under the category of professional technical education that this district has 28 approved professional technical education programs. Those programs are likely to be in any of the 6 career areas that we have in our state, such as natural resources, business and management, arts and communication, industrial and engineering, health services, and human resources. The district relies on the department to develop and identify the knowledge and skills specific to each of these career areas, and we're talking about both academic knowledge, career-related learning knowledge, and technical skills specific to each one of these areas. And they also rely on us to provide tools and resources for developing and teaching quality professional technical education programs and courses that integrate these academic and technical knowledge and skills. The professional technical education quality assurance process, for example, which is also a handout in your packet. This is what it looks like. It's a program quality criteria. Defines the key components of a quality program, and as you can see, student leadership organizations is one of those components of an approved PTE program in our state. And I understand that you had an opportunity to hear from some of our students in the student leadership organizations yesterday. So in relationship to this district specifically, the department administers and manages the Perkins funds associated with these 28 programs. We provide guidance with regard to appropriate expenditures and activities. We have 60 grantees in the state representing districts, community colleges, and regional partnerships. We provide leadership and support to this structure as well as professional development and training, working with our ESD partners, working with the Oregon Association for Career and Technical Education, and specialized customized trainings at the district level. The department also approves community college professional technical education programs on behalf of the State Board of Education. This is done through a collaborative interagency agreement between the Department of Education and the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development that allows us to share resources, share staff, and expertise relative to these programs. One of the things that we try to focus on is really to promote and support development of programs that meet labor market needs, that meet an emerging or an urgent labor market need, and programs that support economic and workforce development in the state on a statewide basis. Over the last 2 years, for example, we issued 4 challenge grants in 4 key areas that the labor market information has indicated that there is a great need for. Those are in the areas of information technology, healthcare, engineering, and education. These grants support statewide partnerships between high schools, community colleges, and universities, where faculty and administrators come together to develop seamless programs that allow students to get the skills that they need in high school that will help them transition to a community college program, any university program, without any interruptions. Some of the key outcomes that result from this relationship is that the district has access to the PTE knowledge and skills for all career areas that the department developed in collaboration with the national efforts and initiatives in these areas, and those are academic and technical and career-related skills. We have quality programs based on industry skill standards. We have programs connected to workforce and economic development. We have programs connected to post-secondary education and training. One of the components for the program approval process, the quality assurance process that I mentioned earlier, is articulation with post-secondary partners. So the program has to be articulated with a community college program or a university program for that matter. If I may direct your attention again to page 6 on the chart, you will see that Bend Lapine has 41 articulated courses with five community colleges, and those community colleges are not restricted to Central Oregon community colleges. They have courses articulated with five throughout the state. And this shows you the number of college credits that students have been able to earn as a result of this articulation between the high school and these community colleges.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Nora, how does this articulation interface with the PTSL programs, the DECA and FFA and these other programs? Are they competitive against one another? Do they work together? Are they funded together? How does that work?
Senator Devlin, Senator Wisnett, the student leadership organizations are... I'm sorry. I was getting it right until now. Excuse me, I'm sorry. Senator Devlin, Senator Wisnett. The student leadership organizations are part of the program, and what we try to do is insist that the organizations not be separate entities operating on the side, but the activities and the focus of those organizations be an integral part of the program. So they're part of the curriculum, they're part of the instruction. It's not something that we do separate from a natural resources program or an agriculture program or a business and management program. And the skills that the students learn in these organizations are very much the same skills that the students would learn in the program. So there is a connection, there is a relevance, they see the application, if you will, of the knowledge and skills that they're learning in the program to real life situations, as is the case with FFA, for example. The skills is what's really articulated between a secondary program and a community college or a university program. So we just make sure that these articulation agreements, whether they are developed at a local level between a school and a community college, or statewide agreements that actually cover programs on a statewide basis, identify the skills and the proficiencies that students are expected to meet in order to be accepted by a post-secondary partner.
Yeah. So how does that... how do I word this? In the governor's budget, those PTLs, the DECA FFA group, are totally defunded. How did that come to pass?
Senator Devlin, Senator Whitsett, the Student Leadership Center was eliminated in the governor's recommended budget. And without those funds are critical to help these student organizations sustain themselves and sustain the activities. I think what we tried to do is focus on the activities that these organizations provide for students and make sure that they're part of the curriculum. What I will share with you is, absent the funding, those programs will be impacted because they will not be able to provide students those extracurricular activities, those community-based activities. So I can't really speak why it was not funded, but what I will share with you is that we try to make sure that these organizations are part of the curriculum and part of the program and not a set-aside activity that's not related to what they do in the classroom.
So if these programs continue to be defunded as they are in the governor's current budget, then your program would essentially replace those programs and what they're doing.
Senator Devlin, Senator Whitsett, we cannot replace them with federal funds. The activities of the student leadership organizations are permissible under Perkins Law, but there is a match and a maintenance of efforts requirement, and we also have to pay attention to the supplanting clause in the federal legislation. If we were to replace those state funds with federal funds, that would be considered supplanting, and we would actually be in violation of federal law and at risk of losing the $32 million that we receive every biennium.
So those are state-funded activities. We do use some of our federal funds to supplant and increase the resources that the center has available. We also offer a tremendous amount of in-kind. Our specialists and managers in the department work very closely with the Student Leadership Center through this contract that we have with Willamette ESD. So we work very closely with the coordinators of the organization. We work closely with the staff at the center, and we also work very closely with the students. Our staff participate in their conferences and activities and support them in every possible way.
Yes, Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Could I follow the money on the professional technical education that you have just on page 6? In relation, just take the one, the lower division college transfer. How are these institutions, reimbursed? I guess, simply put, my question is, that we are potentially looking at in excess of $200,000 for these 2,615 lower division transfer courses articulated with Five Area Community College as part of the ADMW for the Van Lapine or whoever the school district happens to be. We're also potentially $168 plus or minus change, $1,000 for community college FTE here. Double dipping into the state resources for this particular type of activity?
Senator Devlin, Representative Jensen, the articulated agreements that are reached between a school or a district and a community college allows them to use some of the ADM funds that the district receives for that student to pay for some of the costs associated with his or her college education while they're in high school. The law currently allows for community colleges and high schools to work together to facilitate those opportunities for students. The financial arrangements vary from place to place. They vary from community college to community college. In some cases, it's an 80-20 split where the community college that takes responsibility for that student that perhaps has completed all the course offerings that the high school is able to offer them, but yet they still have things that they want to participate in their high school, but the high school has an articulated agreement with the college to offer them access to additional courses and additional opportunities. They reach an arrangement to split the ADM, and it could be a 50-50 split, it could be an 80-20 split, it could be a 90-10. Those arrangements are reached locally. What I can share with you is that as long as that student is a high school student, they're enrolled full-time in their schools, the law currently permits for those relationships to be developed and for those opportunities to be extended to students early on.
Clarification. Okay, I kind of understand that. You talk about the ADM, but what happened to the FTE?
Senator Devlin, Representative Jensen, the student is enrolled in high school as a full-time student. The student can also be enrolled in a community college, not necessarily as a full-time student, but the college also is allowed to generate FTE as a result. And the law and the rules as they currently stand permit for that.
So basically, yes to my question. It is kind of a double dipping.
Senator Devlin, Representative Jensen, and I know Vicky's wanting to weigh in on this.
It's body language.
What I would say, and I'm not trying to avoid answering the question, what I would say is that the law permits for this arrangement to take place.
I'm not suggesting anyone is doing anything illegal, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to follow the money.
Would the one significant difference be, in a sense, is that obviously the student, unlike a regular community college student, isn't paying tuition? Because the tuition is either being paid by the school district and maybe a portion of it by the FTE allotment in the community college.
Is that for me to respond to.
Yeah.
To I understand the student is not paying tuition, which has become more and more prohibitive as we get along here. However, it would strike me that whatever their bargain is with the high school, 80-20, 50-50, or whatever it is, would be the tuition, if you wish, portion of that if they get the FTE. And this 2,500, 2,615 figures out to be about 56 FTE, plus or minus one. The question I'm asking, and I'm not disapproving of this policy, I'm fully supportive of this policy, but is this Harvard type of cost, or is it to us, the state of Oregon, or is it comparable to our other costs for students who aren't involved in these articulations? So, yes, I know the body language is telling me that the assistant superintendent is anxious to set me straight here. So,
Senator Devlin, Representative Jensen, no, I wouldn't presume to set you straight. I just would like to say it sounds like the concern behind your question is, are we paying for something twice? And in fact, since I managed these arrangements prior to coming to the Department of Ed, I know a little bit about one community college and their relationship with the high schools. And the kind of work that's represented in these articulation agreements to allow students the opportunity to gain dual credit in the community college setting and a credit for high school represents a cost in both of those systems. In fact, the community college faculty work very closely with the high school instructors to make sure that the curriculum and the proficiency level demonstrated in the curriculum was adequate and really represented college level work. So, in fact, the financial arrangement, I think, is the thing that has kept us from moving forward in a way for students. We talked yesterday a little bit about the P16 policy work and that we want more opportunities for students if they're ready to gain college credit to have that opportunity systemically. And so we do need to figure out the financial arrangements behind this so that you don't have to ask that question any longer.
I have one question about this. I think in previous testimony we heard something to the effect that 30,000 plus Oregon high school students attend community college. Do we see any patterns in that attendance in the sense of one of the things that I've noticed in some of my districts, and I'm not saying that these occurred on a regular basis before, but occasionally you'll get students within a district who might be better served by an adjacent district. Some of my districts have been reluctant to allow any students to do that simply because they lose the ADMW credit for the student, and just because a student leaves doesn't mean that they need any less teachers or this. Do we see some areas where particular districts have went away from these arrangements because of financial constraints, or are we seeing patterns out there?
Senator Devlin, what we're seeing actually is that districts working together and collaborating to offer students those opportunities.
Okay.
Due to the limited resources, due to the shortage of resources over the past few years, districts have actually collaborated and partnered to offer students opportunities, especially access to professional technical education programs that are costly to maintain and support at an individual school level. So we're seeing districts, as in the case in Polk County, where you have several school districts collaborated together, partnered with Chemeketa Community College, to pool their resources and to eliminate duplication of program offerings. So they offer information technology at one school and students from different districts are allowed to travel to that school to access that program. We saw the same thing with the Center for Advanced Learning in Gresham in partnership, several five school districts in partnership with Mount Hood Community College pooled their resources and partnered to allow students to access those programs at different locations instead of having all five districts
districts offer those programs. So the trend is really is one of collaboration, one of leveraging the resources that districts have available, and looking to establish partnerships with community colleges, for example, to provide access to courses that high schools can't afford to offer anymore. Professional technical education in particular has suffered tremendously as a result of the shortage of resources, because these programs are expensive to maintain, expensive to support, and there is an emphasis on offering students opportunities to concentrate on their academic attainment. Yeah. So the trend is really one of collaboration and partnerships to provide those opportunities for students.
It's a very interesting point, in the sense of I have a lot of schools that have depleted their professional technical at the in order to keep their academic. And it's interesting to me also that neither education reform in this state nor No Child Left Behind really puts much emphasis on professional technical education.
Senator Devlin, we agree with your comment. We're trying to be proactive in terms of how we promote and present professional technical education programs as a vehicle to help students be engaged, to help students be connected and see the relevance of their education. Our efforts with the program approval process, the quality assurance process, focuses on developing rigorous and quality professional technical education programs that include both academic skills and technical skills. And we're trying to pay attention to that as closely as we can. I've gone over my allotted time. I have two areas that I'd like to cover very quickly, if I may.
Yes.
And those are the alternative education and the district and school improvement. Under alternative education, if I may direct your attention again to page 6, you will see that this district has 8 approved alternative education programs. The department is responsible for oversight administration of those programs. We provide assistance. We provide resources. This is based on Oregon statutes and rules. We also provide guidance relative to the offering and maintenance of these programs, student enrollment, registration, financial requirements, program review and evaluation. We also have charter schools listed under the alternative education options that are available for students, and we manage the charter schools grant. We use those resources to promote innovation in the state, and charter schools are growing tremendously in our state. We have 56 charter schools now. So we also work with those schools in the same capacity in terms of grants management and administration, oversight, regulatory guidance, et cetera. And the result is that you have quality alternative education options available for all students that meet the needs of individual students. You have effective and successful charter schools that are sustainable over time, a focus on student achievement, and consistent accountability measures across all these entities. On the district and school improvement area, if I can direct your attention to page 2 of the profile.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Real fast comment. Thank you. I don't have enough information yet. I'm not happy with my school district. Supported charter schools, they've lost a couple. But they just announced this week that they have an online, that the school board approved an online charter school. So I'm interested in seeing how that comes. And if I get information, I'll provide it to the committee members.
The district and school improvement is an area takes a lot of emphasis on our part. In addition to developing and implementing the Division 22 standards that we talked about earlier, that the department is responsible for implementing the accountability measures associated with both the Oregon Report Card and the AYP Federal Report for schools and districts. On page 2, you will see the rankings of those schools based on the Oregon Report Card, ranging from exceptional schools to unacceptable schools. We have the responsibility of developing and implementing the consequences associated of being an unacceptable or low-performing school. And both the federal law and the state law has different requirements, if you will. So we have the responsibility of balancing those out as much as we possibly can and fulfilling our obligations under both state and federal law. Page 2 and 3 also shows you the AYP standings and the information that we use to make the determination if a school is making AYP or not.
Under this area of FORC, we also focus on improvement in three critical areas: literacy, middle school and high school reform, and improvement in closing the achievement gap. The data that you will see on page 2 and 3 of the profile specify the need for us to draw attention to the achievement gap in our state, and particularly at the middle and high school levels. Our emphasis on literacy, and especially adolescent and secondary literacy, is very much linked to closing the achievement gap and making progress in high schools in our state. Literacy is a gateway to student success, and when students learn to read, they are able to learn. The department sets goals for accomplishing these three priorities. We provide professional development and training for teachers and administrators, such as Closing the Achievement Gap Conference, the School Improvement and Literacy Institute, Strategies for Student Success Institute, Cultural Competency and Leadership Institutes. We provide tools and resources for teachers to use for assessing student work, and provide tools for districts for self-assessment and improvement, and we disseminate effective strategies and best practices in all of these areas. The last area is private career schools. It's a different area of responsibility because we deal specifically with private career schools here and not necessarily public schools. In the profile, you will see in this region there are 13 private career schools, and those such as include cosmetology, truck driving, etc. And we also develop and implement standards for quality schools and programs, and provide regulatory guidance relative to ethical business practices, fiscal responsibility, and we monitor to ensure that these districts are in compliance with state and federal law. We try to connect these private career schools with the K-12 system and the university system in an effort to have quality programs and quality options for students. This concludes my presentation, and I'm sorry I have to rush through the last half of it, but thank you very much for the opportunity to share the information, and I'll be happy to answer any questions that you might have, although I hate to get into Doug Costi's time with you, though.
Just one quick comment,
yes.
Mr. Chair. If this publication is an example of the communications arm of the agency, the Department of Education, then the work is... This is an excellent publication. I have been listening, but also taking a look at how the CMCAM information is displayed. And if more of our members could look at this kind of display and get the full context of what it is we're expecting and how CMCAM fits into the expectations, we might have a better understanding of why we have these standards. So, again, kudos to whoever is responsible for putting the information together in this form.
Thank you, Senator Burton.
Ms. Fleming.
Thank you. Well, you can see that it's hard to get all of our explanations in a compressed period of time, but next we'd like to bring up Doug Costi, who's the Assistant Superintendent for Assessment and Information Services in our reorganization. Doug was previously in charge of technology. He has come to the department to work with us on development of the database initiative as an employee of KPMG prior to actually being an employee at the department. We combined assessment and information services in our reorganization because assessment and technology are so closely intertwined, and he's going to talk to you about what all the intricacies of that work look like.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Doug Costi, Assistant Superintendent, Assessment and Information Services. Thank you for the introduction, Vicki, and I'm going to cover three areas today, and I'll try to choreograph what documents I'd like you to take a look at. I'll give you an overview of those documents and try and touch lightly on the more appropriate or applicable ones based on the conversations I heard today, as well as some of the testimony yesterday. Before I get into the work in my office, I've got my packet is the maroon-colored folders, and on the top are my speaking notes for your benefit. You can take notes along with me as I speak or call out anything I might have missed. The next copy is a yellow sheet. It's the strategic plan, and I thought it would be appropriate to start with my office and the units within my office what the strategy is. You're aware that the department is working on a strategic plan. I am very supportive of that because from my background, it's imperative to me that I know what the mission, vision, goals, and objectives of the agency would be so that I can finally align those with my work and be consistent. So just high level, the three points that I'd like to make in terms of my strategic technology plan are I'm looking at increasing the number of online assessment reports to districts. I think we've heard in other conversations throughout Senate and House committees that currently the assessment reports are paper-based. They're late getting to the teachers, and frankly, that's unacceptable. My staff are working on generating web-based reports in a secure environment that can be delivered through PEFs to the schools, districts, and teaching staff. Those reports are specifically class rosters, individual student reports, and group summary reports. In fact, today my staff are meeting with an assessment advisory committee to give them their first glimpse of what those reports will look like. Second item on my strategy is to increase the accuracy and timeliness of data to support state and federal reporting requirements. I build the infrastructure to support all of the data collections that you see and all of the information that's being presented in front of you. That system is extremely broad in its broad and deep in terms of the amount of data that we collect from schools. We recognize that, and there is a lot of pressure being put on schools, and I want to talk to you about that today. And then the third point is to meet the project schedule and budget for the integrated data system, which I'm also going to talk about today, which I believe will really work to pull the enterprise together as a cohesive unit in terms of how we get our arms around the business of education. So anyway, the three areas that I'm going to cover will be first, technology, and I've broken technology into two components, the database and the web, because those are probably the easiest to get your heads around. The second is the integrated data system. It kind of follows, and I know in my speaking points I said I would hit that last, but I'm going to change my mind. I'm going to hit it second. And then third, I'm going to get into the assessment unit. So I've prepared a few talking points. I'll be brief and then let you ask the questions. I think what I can do is high level go through the database and the website so you get a sense of the IS section, launch right into the kids, the integrated data system, and then pause for questions, and then I think we can get into the assessment system. So if that works with you, I'd love to move forward that way. Okay, the first folder contains information on school district report cards, AYP reports, and report summary. And if you open up that folder, you'll see that there's a number of collections. When I talk about the technical infrastructure, I talk about a couple of things in terms of the public website and the district website. This blue piece of paper should be on the left-hand side of the first packet. Contains the web-based data collections, that's the hard-to-read matrix that we require school districts to submit to us in order to calculate adequate yearly progress, provide information on the database initiative, and do our school and district report cards. If you flip that over, I also, part of my team supports a help desk, so you can get a sense for the number of calls that are received by specific area that are logged through our help desk infrastructure. These are just that come through my office. So you can see that roughly 7,700 calls per year from school districts that we attempt to assist on these various data collections. In addition to that, we do provide online training and a monthly data news line, and I have another listserv for the district testing coordinators to keep them in tune with all of our changes and information. So the first thing I'm going to show you is it's kind of a prop I have to give you a sense of the different data collections at the student level. This is just each of these columns represent a student-level data collection that we have. All of the data included in each of those columns are the same, but we take a snapshot of student data at different points of time, and districts extract that data from their systems, provide it to us, and we run validations specific to different columns depending on what point in time it is. It was a little work for the districts to get the data extract put into that format. Once they did that and then began to understand the rules behind it, they're feeling more and more comfortable with it. You can just set it down. It's fine.
Clarification on that. Would this data, part of the purpose for the data project that's in this budget and every other budget that we have, I mean, not every budget, but community colleges and higher ed, mm-hmm. is to track individual students. The data you're now talking about, is it basically, it's both probably tracking students in categories, and it may be actually at least providing assessment scores for individual students, but no.
Chair Devlin, this does not provide assessment data. We at my office actually administers the assessments. We gather the assessment results, and then we push that data back to the district. So this represents only those student-level data collections that we need in order to satisfy the requirements of No Child Left Behind's adequate yearly progress and report card. We also use these data to calculate average daily membership for the formula. So some of the state school fund components are baked into these data collections as well.
So I know it's a little bit more complex than this, so that what we would see here is the much more data than that, but the grade level data, but then the subgroupings within that grade level.
Let me just go through what's in here.
Yeah.
Just at a very high level, there's demographic information, the name of the child, the birth date, the gender, the ethnicity, program information, such as is this child registered in a professional technical program, what classes is he taking or she taking, the special ed child count information, basic information about is this child registered in a special ed program, what's the IEP, we collect data for the assessment precode for the assessments that we push out in a paper-based environment or post on TESA. That information needs to be in our system before the kids can take a test. Migrant indicators are baked into this. Behavioral, suspensions, truancies, early leavers, graduation, and completer type of data, those are all collected now through this format. So now I'm going to step back a bit. That's just a data collection, if you will, and there are many other of those data collections, but those are new this year. The last time I came to Four Ways and Means in the 0103 session, I gave the subcommittee an indication that we were going to get to this level of detail. Well, we're there, and we're moving forward. What we do with this data is put it in a series of databases. So these are the containers that hold the information. And we have databases on institution boundaries. That's information about schools, districts, programs, charter schools, all of the entities. If you're familiar with the school directory, I wish I would have brought a copy of the school directory. It's a book about that thick that has all of the information on superintendents, principals, schools, addresses, all of that information comes from that database, and we use that database to publish that report. Very valuable report. We quit printing it 2 years ago in an effort to save some publication and distribution costs, and we got a great deal of pushback from districts saying, no, we want a paper copy of that report on our desk. So we did bring that printing back. We have information on student performance. We are now in our third year. We have 3 years worth of longitudinal data and are able to present reports that Representative March referred to for the Multnomah ITAX community. We're doing some work on closing the achievement gap with these data, and it's a great opportunity to open the discussion about building a value-added model so that we can see how kids or groups of kids are doing in cohort based on different attributes. So how are the tag kids doing? How are the kids that start started up here doing at the end of the year? Are we paying attention to the high-end learners as well as the low-end learners? What are the kids with low SES factors doing? What are the ethnic groups doing? We can now slice and dice that data at that level of detail. The database initiative data, that's a database that contains all sorts of information. The report that Salam provided you, most of the data there came from that container of information. It's financial information. It's information on teachers. It's information on schools and their processes and student-level information that we aggregate for that purpose. Salam also mentioned the grants management, and I think Brett will talk about that a bit in his conversation. We developed a database to contain all of the financial and reporting information for grants management. There's also a budget reporting system that allows each assistant superintendent to manage their budget based on the information that's contained in the statewide financial management application. SFMA. Okay, so that's the database side. So we've got all this stuff in these wonderful databases or containers. So how do you get it out there? That's the second part of my conversation relative to the information services, and that's the web. We have two formats for the web. We have a public website where you can go get all sorts of information. You can get documentation, you can get policies, you can get numbered memorandums. School districts use that all the time for information that the department distributes. It also contains information on AYP and report card. And in the first folder, for your reference at any point, are those reports. That's just a sample report of a school and district report card and AYP report. We also have another website. It's referred to as the district website. And that's where all of our stakeholders go to get information about different program areas, their data collections. Within there is a central login. It's all secure. They have to have a password and ID. We built the infrastructure to manage that. But districts have to have a security administrator that is responsible for assigning login IDs and passwords for appropriate staff to log into that site so they can do data collections and validation of their data. Also on that website are manuals and documentations about the various data collections and reports. So how do we communicate with the field? What do we do to make sure that, you know, we're not sitting up here in our ivory tower and making all of these decisions? My staff have several advisory groups that we meet with. I meet quarterly with the assessment advisory group. They're meeting today. They give us advice on scheduling, testing formats, reports, and those kind of things. They're our eyes and ears in the field. I meet on a monthly basis with the IT directors from the large data centers throughout the state, and I host quarterly meetings with the IT directors from any district that wants to attend here in Salem. And we also have a data collection committee that is made up of program folks from within the district and within the department, and we facilitate those meetings on a quarterly basis to give districts the opportunity to come in and give their input on these data collections that we have.
I'm actually itching to ask a question, and you might want to respond to it, but Ms. Fleming might want to respond to it also. I think the data collection efforts are very important to managing a school district and managing an individual school and meeting the needs of children. But one of the areas I'm most interested in, which I don't believe we're at that point yet, is that when we do this, and this could be part of your web-based system in terms of, is when we do the assessments, like, for instance, in the 8th grade or 10th grade, if they're in math and English, how soon that information gets back to the classroom teacher, because that's the part of the data system that I'm most interested in. Because if, you know, go 8th, 10th, we could go 3rd, 5th, but I'll use 8th and 10th because most commonly those are students are in multiple different classrooms in a day. There are multiple different teachers. students not achieving well in English, I think that's probably should be a responsibility of every teacher that they have, maybe not just their English teacher, or mathematics. I'll narrow that a little bit, but the idea of being able, the data is good if you get it back and you can use it. But what we've heard sometimes, and it's not just Oregon, other states, is assessments are done and months later the teachers can actually see how the student scored. And to give teachers at least some leeway in this, when you get into the 8th and 10th grade, particularly if you're in one of the schools that still has like 7 or 8 periods a day, you might have 150 or 180 students in a day. So trying to track how every student is doing is not as easy as it maybe used to be.
Chair Devlin, I'd really like to respond to that, and I think I will, because it kind of segues into the next conversation with the K-12 integrated data system. First of all, if the child takes their test on TESSA, they get their results immediately. So that individual student sees whether they how they did on the test as soon as they hit the finish button. The district will then receive a data set within 48 hours of that submission. And so if a class of 30 children took the test, they will see the results of that test back within a 48-hour time frame, 48 working hours. The paper and pencil tests, however, are less efficient. It takes time to get the information because we have to gather up the paper copies. We have to ship them to a scanning site who then scans them, does some quality assurance checks against their scanning processes, puts that information into a database, and then submits it. So it could be several weeks before the district actually sees the results of those scores.
Can you distinguish between those types of tests?
Yes. TESSA or web-based. TESSA is the web-based testing environment where a child sits in front of a computer and the test is delivered to the kid right there in the classroom. The paper and pencil test is just that. A booklet is printed, it is distributed to the schools, and it's ordered in advance so the schools get it. And the children sit down in an environment to take the paper and pencil test. They bubble in the score sheets.
I'm just trying to figure out if I'm confusing something, because is when you say TESSA, is it in reference that it would be available for any of the assessment tests if you had the technology?
Good clarification.
Yes.
That's not exactly true. We have in the past, when we had math problem solving, you could not administer that through a TESSA environment because of the type of test that we had. It was only paper and pencil. Currently, the writing assessment is only a paper and pencil. We are moving toward a web-based test environment for writing.
But math and English, you can do now tests if you have the technology.
Yes, with the exception of some accommodations for children with special needs.
Right.
Okay.
Thank you.
You betcha.
Senator Nelson.
On the TESSA program, what I'm understanding and hearing from other folks is there's really getting to be some pretty sophisticated programs, and that potentially Department of Education should be looking at some of those that expand what TESSA's doing and can give you even better information. Is that correct?
Chair Devlin, Senator Nelson, that's exactly correct. And thank you for reminding me, because the other part of your question was, how do the teachers get that information? Some districts don't have the capacity to actually pull that information together. They can download a data set from us, but it doesn't do them much good unless they have a front end or an application that serves that information out to those individual teachers and classrooms. So there is where we're going to segue into the integrated data system conversation to talk about where are the opportunities to create more efficient and effective applications and systems for the classroom. How can we take the money that's being currently spent on technology, mush it together, and come up with applications that everybody has access to that provide more classroom assistance, more information to the teachers and to the students. So with that, I'm going to launch into the integrated data system, if that's okay. First of all, before I do that, I want you to know that the Oregon Department of Education is one of the 12 participating agencies in the Computing and Network Infrastructure Consolidation and
initiative. This is being run out of the Department of Administration, Information Resources, and Management Division. What that essentially is a consolidation of all of the data centers of the major 12 agencies within the state, and putting it into a single facility. What that does is it collapses all the hardware, the operating systems, into groups of types of the technical infrastructure. So the staff that we each have in our different agencies will be co-located, or we will turn that functionality over. So part of our budget, there is a note in there for noting that we're a participant. So we look forward to that. We endorse that concept. The reason I bring that up now is to compare and contrast the initiatives between what I refer to as KIDS and CSAP, which I'll get into in a minute, and the data center for the state government. State agencies, the 12 state agencies that are represented in the data center consolidation project, are very heterogeneous. We all have different businesses that we attend to. Okay. In contrast, the integrated data system that we're proposing for K-12 is a homogeneous environment. Currently, there are about 40 data centers throughout the state. So if you can imagine, there's 40 sets of servers and hardware, and there are 40 sets of staff that manage that information. And when I come up and ask for that type of an extract, it has to be done about 30 or 40 different times, depending on who the vendor is. Not very efficient. Also, back to Chair Devlin's comment about how do the teachers get that information, this is why it's important to try to figure out what's the best way to consolidate. So I'm going to talk about two things within KIDS. And I've given you the reference documentation, but I think I can talk you through it in a few minutes, so you can kind of get your heads around what the two pieces are. There's two pieces. Each of the sectors, if you will, community college, K-12, and higher ed, have had a placeholder in their budget for an integrated data system. Our component of that is a $300,000 piece of the $1.8 million that I'm referring to. And what that does is allow for the extract of high school student information that those kids that want to go to school up into a post-secondary environment within Oregon will have the option to have their data extracted from our system with their student ID. So what that does, it's very powerful in that it gives the high or the post-secondary institution basic information about that student that they won't have to key back in. It also provides information on how they did in their classes, in their various coursework, how they did with their overall GPA. It also gives them performance information on how they did with the statewide assessments. And it can provide also some additional information in terms of what programs they went into. What that does then is it allows the post-secondary community to gather it. The initiative isn't an efficiency piece from that perspective of moving the data, but it's more about helping inform instruction. So some of you have heard of the PASS first year study. How did our kids do their first year in the university system? What this allows to happen is we can not just look at pieces of information or snippets of students. We can look at the entire student population of Oregon students that went on to higher education, post-secondary education. That information then can be analyzed, and information can then be fed back to K-12 to say, hey, how effective were we really in delivering our instruction? We thought these kids were ready for high school or for college. Were they really ready? Where do we need to focus our attention? Is it on more math, more science, more reading, more writing? It would provide that level of detail. So that's what I call the vertical integration of data, that component. The other piece of it, the kids piece, is pre-K through 12, and that is gathering information about children as soon as they hit our system. We're currently doing a pre-K database. We're in the development stages of that for the pre-K kids and populations. So we will have information on individual students as soon as they start hitting the educational enterprise at whatever level. We'll know what programs they took. We'll know when they entered. We'll know when they exited. It's a wealth of information. The problem that districts have today, I've already pointed to one of them, is, you know, all of the duplicity. The other piece is when a child moves from one district to another, it takes weeks and sometimes months to get the kids' information, their record set, over to the teacher. The teacher needs that information. What I've heard is the teacher needs to know basic information about a student. Does this child have a truancy problem? Does this child have an IEP? What grades have they been getting? It's crucial information so that when the child comes to the front door of the school, that teacher knows what to do with it. So that's the what I'll refer to as the horizontal data system. There are three phases to that. Phase one is the business case, and that has just started, and I hired IBM to come in and take a look at the enterprise from their background. They've done some work in many other states. They're currently in North Carolina, which is a very centralized state, and they've done work in Ohio that is a decentralized state, providing great information for us. That work is due to be completed in mid-July, and what we're hoping out of that is we'll have a business case that will say, yes, this really makes sense to do. Here's some of the issues that you need to look out for. Here's some of the lessons learned from those that tried it, didn't work. And then phase two, which the $1.5 million that I'm asking for, is a requirements analysis. I think you heard Jerry Wilson yesterday, Superintendent Wilson, talk about, he was asked the question, how's this going to work? And he said, well, it's risky. Yes, it is risky. And we know full well how risky it is, but I think the benefits outweigh some of the risks. And if we stay focused on what the primary issues are and where we can realize the greatest efficiencies, and that's what we're hoping the business case will outline for us, we feel we can be successful in this area. So phase two is take it slow. I want to know what it is we're going to do. I want an implementation strategy, and I want a small pilot. Perhaps something to feed information back to the teachers, classroom teachers, would be a good way to provide some information and prove the concept that this could really happen. So phase two, the $1.5 million, is requirements analysis and implementation strategy. Phase three, that would be the implementation phase and probably would not be scheduled to occur until the 07-09 biennium. You need to know that I have been talking to ESD and district IT managers. They are on board. They were the ones that came to me and said, we can't handle it anymore. We're getting cut. We can't handle the cutbacks anymore. We need to do a better job of consolidating and reducing these redundancies. I'm hoping you'll hear later from on Thursday during public testimony. Some of those folks will hopefully come up and talk about their needs and what they've seen. We will look at best practices. Idaho, some of you may be familiar with, did a student information consolidation, and it didn't go so well. They currently they put the project on hold. Albertson's Foundation put some money up, about $45 million, to create a data center. It was a top-driven approach, and they built the data center. They put people in there, and they called in Capgemini and a consultant to do a risk analysis last fall, and they recommending putting the project on mothballs. So we are aware of those scenarios, and we will watch those type of things very closely. We believe there is enough information, there is enough evidence out there to say, here's where you need to focus your attention. As Ken Thrasher mentioned yesterday, this is a long-term vision. It's not something we can do within a two-year period. It's something that we need to set our sights on and strive for, and it will take some time to get there. I heard also yesterday Senator Gordley asked the question, what's the impact of legislature not making investment? That's a difficult one to answer at this point in time. It's kind of like the No Child Left Behind, what it's going to take to get everybody to that point. What I'm hoping is that the business case can, we will incorporate that question into the business case and see what kind of answer we can come up with. So I'm going to stop there with my conversation on information services and the integrated data system and allow you to ask me some questions before I move into the assessment system.
Any additional questions? Senator Gordon.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And I appreciate your response to the question I raised. As I'm hearing your presentation, I would just say that the obvious impact would be not making the investment means we lose the capacity for having diagnostic tools, if you will, that help us drill down right to the child in the school level and understand what that child's needs are. So that's how I'm hearing what the impact would be.
Chair Devlin, Senator Gordley, that's one facet, yes. The other facet is the duplicity that the redundancy in the systems that we have right now. Currently, there are multiple vendors. There are instances of a single vendor application in multiple sites. That means that a set of hardware and in four sites, and I'm not going to name the vendor and I'm not going to name the sites, but there are four sites that have the same vendor that have the same sets of hardware, operating system, and professional staff needed to manage that information. And some of those sites are serving that or hosting that application to other districts. It doesn't make sense to me. The other piece of it is I'm going back to the homogeneous system within the enterprise. Why is it that a district in Eastern Oregon, Central Oregon, what's different about a district in Eastern Oregon, Central Oregon, or in the Willamette Valley that they need to have a separate system for student information, for HR, and for finance? We all are on the same chart of accounts. All enterprises have the same mission, goals, and objectives.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. Just a couple of questions. One is, part of our charge is to do this performance measuring thing. Do you have any performance measures that actually all this data collecting and all this processing actually shows an improvement in students' ability? I mean, that's what our charge is, I guess. Can we actually show that there is a direct correlation that our students are doing better in English because of the things that you're doing?
Chair Devlin, Senator Nelson, and I'm going to refer to Representative March's comments about the Multnomah ITACs. Specifically, that information, I believe Representative March could probably weigh in on it more effectively than I can, demonstrated that, and Senator Gordley certainly demonstrated that the investment made in these areas was of an adequate amount to demonstrate that we have the information, we can put it back into the hands of the stakeholders that need it, and we can prove whether or not it made a difference. I think I've talked to different committees and said, I'm policy agnostic. I'm here to build an infrastructure, and I will build the facts. I will bring you the facts, and the facts are what they are.
But we're also, Mr. Chair, talking about, in the Multnomah County case, Representative March, a targeted investment in evidence-based practices that then gives us those results.
Right.
Did you want to comment, Representative Jensen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Some concern, I suppose, what's going to be, assuming we move ahead with this, some concern about the actual cost of equipment, of hardware, software type of thing. Going to have a lot of equipment apparently that's going to become obsolete very quickly around the state, and if you're able to put some of this type of thing together, what's going to be the life expectancy? How many biennium are we going to go through before you're coming back and saying we need to... And that will be an important question for me as I weigh in on the decision of where this type of thing goes, because my personal observation that one of the biggest conspiracies in the history of this country was the high-tech industry, because every time you turn around and get something, buy something, and implement it, before you punch the first key, it's obsolete. What's the life expectancy? What do you have you thought about that question as you?
Chair Devlin, Representative Jensen, yes, we have. Actually, as part of the business case, we've asked for a total cost of ownership approach, which gets at the life expectancy of different layers of the technical infrastructure. I believe it's naive to think that you can make one investment in technology and that's going to last you for 10 years. Depending on the layer of technology that we're talking about, for example, operating systems typically have to be upgraded on a very regular basis. They need to be upgraded because they need to address security issues with the system, new hacker threats, those kind of things. The hardware will last a lot longer. The server farms will last quite a bit longer. But you balance that against what you're paying in maintenance costs over what you get out of your initial costs. You look at, for example, in the server environment, how much does it cost me on an annual basis for maintenance versus what can I purchase that server for over a five-year period or six-year period or eight-year period. Absolutely, you have to make an investment in technology. Desktops are a great example. We've all seen the desktops that we use in our homes deteriorate after about 2 to 3 years of use. I mean, the operating systems get up here, all of the hacker attacks get to your environments, and you have to continually upgrade the operating system, and eventually the hardware is so far behind that you have to upgrade that. So all of those are to be addressed in the business case and the implementation strategy.
I think, though, one commentary on that, Representative Jensen, in that conspiracy going away from the government side is, I think one problem that one of my major corporate entities is having in Washington County is for PCs. Once you get to a certain speed level, instant, you can't get much better than instantaneous. You can if you want it for other applications, but once PCs are practically instantaneous, I think they're finding a difficulty getting people wanting to upgrade to half, to faster speeds in terms of what systems operate at now.
Mr. Chair, yep. Can I withdraw the term conspiracy and substitute in its place the term marketing?
Yes. Or planned obsolescence.
Yeah, you know. Chair Devlin, members of the committee, I'm going to go ahead and proceed through the rest of my presentation. A couple things. If you open up your folder on assessments, it's the third folder. I wanted to give you a glimpse of the chart that we're running on the number of web-based tests. I think this is important for you to see in terms of the usage over the past three biennium. You can see where we're at today is at the end of March, we are exceeding where we were last year at the end of May. We're projecting that we will hit 800,000 web-based tests this year. That's a lot of web-based testing. The more kids we get on that web-based environment, the more efficient our operation is. I'm going to just jump right now to the purple folder, or the purple set of handouts. This is information that I provided for House audits, and I thought it would be relevant for this discussion on Appendix B, the item development estimate. If you look down at the bottom, last year in 03-04, we developed 13,400 operational items at a total cost of $960,000. Cost per operational item is $72. The second page on that handout.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Could you give us the non-techies? What is that, good? Is that bad?
I believe, from my perspective, and looking at what other states are paying for items, that's very good. That's very efficient. And I would like to add that the department has been doing this for some number of years. This portion of our process is very mature. It is a practice that is used, and a methodology that is used by the private sector, by the publishing companies. So I think, in terms of the different pieces of the assessment system, this is a very mature and industry standard process. I'm going to jump now to just a reference for Appendix C. These are the various types of assessments that we administer. And in earlier testimony, I heard conversations about, well, what do we do? What if we only did AYP and not report card? The purpose of this document is to show you what's required by adequate yearly progress, what's required by report card, and what's required by IDEA or special education. You'll notice on the bottom that science, while it's not checked yet for AYP and report card, it will be required or to be administered in the 07-08 biennium. And districts were required to test in 02-03 for SIM on science. So you can see at the bottom of that, we administered over 1.1 million tests last year. If we are on target to do that this year, we'll probably do more this year. I'm guessing 60 to 70% of our tests will be web-based. That's important as we turn the page and we talk about what the cost of this assessment system is, because the costs of web-based assessments are high in fixed costs and low in variable costs. What that means is the more tests I can cram through that mechanism, the less it costs me per test to administer. I've circled the different components of this, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time. I want to give you an opportunity to read it, digest it. The first component is overall the various phases of the assessment system. We have about 29.75 FTE allotted to that process. We spend $16.4 million over a biennium on that assessment system. Our contracted component of that is about $11.8 million. So you can see we contract out about 75% of the work on this process. A good deal of those, what I term contracts, are actually teachers. And we used to contract with them, but because of federal regulations, we turned them into temporary employees. So if you see a whole bunch of temporary employees in my area, it's the teachers that help write the items and score the exams.
Can you finish in about 1 minute? Because I need to do an announcement before the committee leaves.
Sure. The other two, sections two and three, are the costs for performance assessments. And the final section is section four, where you asked the department to outline the costs for AYP and report card to generate the cost, or generate the AYP reports and the report card costs. AYP costs $600,000 to produce that information and post it, and the report card is $145,000. And that will conclude my testimony, and I'll be happy to answer any questions or come back at a later date.
Thank you very much. Any questions from the committee? Hearing them next week, I'd like to announce, and I want to thank you all for your testimony, and we will see you back on Tuesday. Did you have anything that you wanted to say, Ms. Fleming, at this point?
I just have a closing remark from you.
Okay.
Sure.
Just to let the committee know, on Monday, we will be back for a work session on the chiropractic examiner. I've delayed the dentist for a week in case any of you by tomorrow tell me that there's an issue with the dentist that you'd like to address. We have the health licensing office and a health licensing office fee bill on Monday also. On Tuesday, we have the Department of Education and the State School Fund, and we'll try to complete most of the work on that on Tuesday. It may spill a little bit over to Wednesday. On Wednesday, I've asked for some invited testimony to come in on a few areas that have been highlighted by members. One of them has not been highlighted by members, but has been brought to my attention, a budget note regarding ESL, English as a second language education, and some work that the department has done. Also, I know that Senator Nelson and Senator Gordley are interested in having a spokesman here from the Frontier Learning Network. They will be here on that day. And although I've not talked to Representative Jensen about this, I know that Representative Jensen is very interested, as the rest of the committee is, about the future of SMART. So I'm going to get a spokesman here from SMART on Wednesday to talk about that program, along probably with someone from the Department of Education and the governor's education liaison. On Thursday, we will have a public hearing again on both the Department of Education and the State School Fund. I recognize and I really appreciate the members that were able to stay late earlier this week. I recognize that that's not really possible on a regular basis. And particularly I know that next week, given I think there's a number of measures that might be coming to the Senate floor, I don't believe they will let us stay here when those measures come to the Senate floor. So I'm going to try to do some things a little bit differently. We will have other opportunities for public testimony in addition to this on the State School Fund and Department of Ed. But I'm going to try to limit it just specifically to the 2 hours that we have. That clearly means if we have too many people, there's never too many people that want to testify, that we may not actually get to everybody that's in the room. And I think that's unfortunate, but the realities of this building is that normally I would only have 2 hours to do this within. So I may have to virtually limit people to 3 minutes. I will try to be a little bit flexible in that. I felt a little bit uncomfortable with the young students last week because many of them had prepared testimony, and they were all very well practiced in their prepared testimony. I felt at times that if I was to interrupt them, their testimony might last longer if I interrupted them in the middle of their testimony. So we're going to try the best we can to keep that within the two-hour time frame because I know all of you are busy. And many of you will not be able to stay here after the time, and I'm not intending to stay after 10:30. We will potentially have, and we'll be talking about that next week also, some outside-the-building hearings. And so there will be more opportunities for people to testify, and I haven't told the LFO staff about this. We may need to plan. There probably will only be two of those. I think that's all the president is going to fund, or the speaker. We may have to plan on potentials of sitting in testimony for four or more. Well, I think you lose consciousness after about 4 hours. But those may be rather long hearings, to be just perfectly honest about it. So,
are you, Mr. Chair, looking at evening hearings?
Yes.
Me.
You are, of course, defying one of the basic principles of education. Where they have learned that there's a direct correlation between learning and time spent on the seat of one's
fritters. Yes. I understand
there's
that.
There's a diminishing return that goes with that.
But I believe that we will be looking at potentially one hearing that will be, well, they will both probably be evening. One will be probably close enough so that parties will not need to make alternative plans for where they're staying. One may be far enough away where it's not realistic for you to be returning to Salem. In some cases, well, not realistic for you to return to Salem. I'll leave it at that.
Mr. Chair, an encouragement to also look at adding evening hearings so that we're not so restricted in opportunities for the public to testify.
Yeah, I agree with you, Senator Gordley, and we will try to work on a little bit more on that. Senator Gordley and I have had many discussions with the co-chair, many discussions, and with that,
Anything additional from the committee? And Ms. Fleming, did you want to make a closing remark, and we'll close that?
Thank you, Senator Dunham. Just very quickly, I just wanted to sort of tie up where we are now, and I think there are three questions that were asked today that really sort of are exemplary of the struggle that we're having, and got to our original statement about being an agency in transition. Representative Jensen asked the question about professional development and how do we know whether it's any good or not. And Senator Gordley, you asked about the cost of No Child Left Behind and how is it that we fund getting all students to standard. That really references the question for us, is money tied to results, and how do we know? How do we know what we're spending and what we're anticipating getting for it? And then does information, Senator Nelson asked, does this information really impact student achievement? I think those three questions, and in our attempt to integrate the work of the agency and try to be a balance between a state centralized operation and a decentralized system or enterprise, if you will, are really that is the work that we have before us. And so I just wanted to tie that together and tell you that we'll be thinking about that and addressing in the rest of our presentation how the agency works toward those outcomes.
Okay. Representative Jensen, and then
very quickly on the issue of professional development and its relative worth. I would kind of like to share some conversations with you about the methodologies that are used in relation to the collection of that information.
Thank you very much. With that, we will close the hearing and close the committee till Monday morning. And there's no poll tomorrow.